Hello, everyone. This is Viviana Young. I'm the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps and the new host of Living Downstream. With me today are Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds, Casey Hobick, and Coordinator for the Forest Waters Coalition, Sam Kropp. Let's take a moment to pause for a land acknowledgement to remember that various Indigenous groups once tended the lands and waters of the Umpqua Watershed, including Cow Creek, Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. It's important to know who and what came before. Their story is part of our history. Sam, could you start us off today by telling us a little bit about the Forest Waters Coalition, how they were founded, who they are, and what they do?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the program. I'm really pleased to be here to talk about one of my favorite topics. I, as you said, am the Coalition's coordinator for the Forest Waters Coalition, and we are a network of grassroots organizations, conservation organizations, and also community members, community-based organizations, who are working together to reform Oregon's logging laws that apply to private industrial lands and state lands. And so there's been a lot of work that's happened under the banner of this coalition, and it really was founded from a lot previous work for, you know, years and decades, basically founded by Oregonians who were fed up with the way that their backyard forests were being managed and were concerned about things like clear-cut logging and aerial spraying, which were literally and continue to degrade watersheds and often poison our drinking water supplies. And so this movement really started to gain momentum, and the coalition was founded as a way to sort of work together and get a bunch of organizations singing to the same tune when it came to actually advancing material protections for our forested drinking watersheds. And the big first effort that came out of the Forest Waters Coalition was a ballot initiative that was being advanced by a number of grassroots community members who were being directly impacted by aerial spraying of chemicals by helicopters, a practice that often happens after logging. And that ballot initiative was being advanced and was going to go on the November 2020 ballot. But what happened from there was an agreement that came out of that movement process. And basically, instead of going to the ballot, a number of organizations agreed to sit at the table and kind of come up with some concrete protections that they felt were a small step forward. And so that was kind of the beginning of the coalition, was this background of an incredibly robust grassroots network, and then this effort to put an initiative on the ballot, which turned into a deal between conservation groups and industrial timber, which we now see as a small step in a good direction, but definitely not the end of the work. And so where we're at right now as a coalition is kind of circling back to what were the things that our grassroots communities really, really needed to see, and what is the work that's left to be done. And so I can totally talk more about all of those things, but that's kind of the genesis, one of the wins along the way, but obviously there's so much work to be done, and we're gaining member organizations all the time to help us with that work.
Sam, Umpqua Watersheds is really proud to be a part of the Forest Waters Coalition. The energy and organization of this collaboration has really meant a lot to us, and the ability to connect with several different organizations. Can you tell us how many organizations are part of the Forest Water Coalition?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, the Forest Waters Coalition is 21 member organizations. And like I said, you know, we have a number of classic conservation organizations, including Oregon Wild and Cascadia Wildlands, Audubon Society of Portland. And we also have, you know, more riverkeeper oriented organizations who focus on protection of watersheds and aquatic species, like Rogue Riverkeeper and Tualatin Riverkeeper, and like you all with Umpqua Watersheds. And then we also have a number of grassroots community organizations who represent groups like the North Coast Communities for Watershed Protection and Williams Community Forest Project, who are really rooted in monitoring and protecting specific places and specific community watersheds from industrial logging practices. So it's kind of a beautiful mix of organizations who come at it from different angles, some of them with grassroots tactics, some of them with legal and policy angles, some of them from an administrative framework working with agencies. And together we sort of try to, like I said before, sing to the same tune and really work together to amplify our movement power.
Thank you, Sam. It's really great to have someone like you who protects the environment and advocates for it, along with all of the other members of the coalition. So can you tell me how you personally got involved? Like, what drew you to the topic?
Yeah. Interestingly, one of the reasons that I moved to the Pacific Northwest from where I'm from, Florida, about 10 years ago, was because I wanted to get involved in forest protection. I recognized that forests are just an incredible collective resource that we have, and that they're being threatened at an alarming rate, and that our native forests are really diminishing at an alarming rate. And so I moved out here with the intention of working on forest protection. And my first involvement was in protecting and fighting logging projects that were particularly destructive, clear-cut logging projects on federal lands. And I spent many years doing that work, working primarily on public lands, federal public lands, and then recognized through that work that there's sort of an elephant in the room this whole time. And that elephant in the room is that meanwhile, the worst kinds, the far most destructive, scarring, lasting logging activities are happening actually on private industrial lands. And these lands are a significant portion of Oregon. And I think that folks kind of forget about them because most of the attention is on the timber wars of public lands, of federal lands. But these private industrial lands are where so much of the damage is happening, and particularly the damage for our watersheds. And so when I started to kind of look closer at this and to work more with community members, especially coastal community members on the coast of Oregon, who are particularly, many of those watersheds are primarily owned by industrial timber, private industrial timber, I began to realize that there was a major piece missing in the work that I'd been doing. And that in order to really get at the heart of this destruction that we're seeing, we needed to work on reforming private industrial forest management. We needed to stop the spraying of chemicals that were wafting into people's community water supplies that were happening on private industrial lands. And we needed to stop the, you know, huge, huge hundreds and hundreds of acres of consecutive clear cutting that we were seeing scarring the landscape on private industrial lands. And because of the way that Oregon's history has played out, these private industrial lands are scattered in somewhat of a checkerboard pattern throughout much of Oregon, especially on the western side of Oregon. And so we can't kind of ignore these lands when we're talking about forest preservation or talking about forest defense in federal lands, because they're scattered throughout our federal lands and our public lands. They're scattered throughout our backyards. And they're, you know, for rural Oregonians, that is their backyards. And so this is a huge issue. And I think historically, forest defense has focused on private lands. And I think the next frontier in terms of what we need to do, I think really has to be focused on reforming our private industrial land laws.
Do you or anyone close to you personally live near the woods?
So I right now live in Portland, which is not ever where I thought I would be. I'm not quite a city person, but you know, life is a surprising and wild thing. And so here we are. But I work really closely with folks who live in rural communities across the state. And when I was living in Eugene, which was for the most of my time on this coast, I lived rurally just outside the city on a really sweet little goat farm. And that's where I started to really, really dig into kind of working more, organizing more directly with frontline communities. And so I think it's important to define what we're talking about here when we say frontline communities, because that word is used a lot. And I think when we talk about this engagement with private industrial forest lands, the frontline communities are rural communities whose backyards are being clear cut and whose drinking water and wells are being sprayed. And so I started kind of working with those communities when I was living in Eugene on that goat farm. And a lot of it looked like just kind of knocking doors and connecting with people on the ground near places that were supposed to be getting clear cut. And through that practice and through organizing with groups like Cascadia Wildlands with really robust grassroots teams, I learned a lot about, you know, what folks in these communities were feeling and different value systems. And one thing that I really learned, a huge takeaway, is that despite the timber industry rhetoric, which may argue that rural communities only want to see more logging, so many rural Oregonians are deeply concerned about the industrial logging that they're seeing happening in their communities. And I think these concerns are being greenwashed or whitewashed by industrial logging, by big timber, which is essentially saying, you know, there's nothing to see here. We are the lifeblood of rural communities. And so through, you know, connecting with communities across Western Oregon, you know, community members living right near timber sales that we were trying to fight. And then later through organizing folks who were monitoring private industrial clear cuts, I learned that, you know, this is a huge issue. It's one of the top issues for rural Oregonians. And, you know, it was an issue when I lived rurally too, thinking about cutting and spraying happening near me. And the more education that we do on this issue, the more people recognize that, you know, the practices happening now are not okay. And so I think my biggest takeaway is kind of like the unpeeling of the facade that, you know, rural communities just want to see more logging, because that just isn't the case.
Yes, I certainly agree. And I just want to give you recognition for what you've done, Sam. I've known you for several years, and your dedication and passion for making a difference has inspired a lot of people, as has the coalition. We've worked together. We're up against some challenges with a very organized industry that had sometimes taken the narrative away because of the economy and those issues. But you've shown through your passion and commitment to this organization and to conservation in the Pacific Northwest that an individual can make a difference. And those types of contributions that we have with organizations and people that are part of the Forest Waters Coalition really gives us all hope. It's not easy being green, as the saying goes, because we're small and we're diverse and we're spread up across rural communities and cities. And how does that all come together? But you're one of the people that have shown that we can do this. And I think that's really important. So let's talk a little about the Private Forest Accord. I know it's 13 industry groups and 13 conservation groups, of which Umpqua Watershed is a part of that group. Can you tell us a little about what the Private Forest Accord is and what it accomplished and the controversies surrounding it to some extent?
Thank you so much, Casey, for those incredibly kind words. I will say that it has been an absolute pleasure working with all of the folks in this movement at all levels. And there is some really passionate, dedicated, powerful people involved in this movement. And it's just been truly, truly amazing to get to know more of those people. So shout out to all of you out there doing this work. We have a mighty, mighty team. And to answer your question specifically about what the Private Forest Accord accomplished, this is really a big question, and there's a lot to it. So I'll just dive right in, starting with how we even got to this place. So to kind of start at the beginning, I want to reiterate something I mentioned earlier, which is that the efforts to reform Oregon's private logging laws have been going on for a very long time. This Private Forest Accord is a monumental step in an important direction that is not ahistorical, but came out of decades of really hard-fought work on behalf of many Oregonians, especially rural Oregonians who are on the front lines of the consequences of private industrial, irresponsible, clear-cut plantation-style management. So how did this come about? Against the backdrop of many efforts to try and reform Oregon's logging laws, in 2019, there emerged a clear effort to get something on the citizens' ballot, to write a grassroots ballot initiative. And the idea was to rewrite the Oregon Forest Practices Act, commonly called the OFPA, to expand protections for our waterways, our forested watersheds. Now, the Oregon Forest Practices Act was passed in 1971. And you can imagine that obviously those protections are outdated at this point. And Oregon, as it stands before, you know, and still until we actually get the agreement across the final finish line in the legislature, Oregon State stands vastly behind in terms of protections for our forested waterways, especially even in comparison to our neighboring states of Washington and California. Oregon's laws regulating what can and cannot happen surrounding even fish-bearing streams, salmon-bearing streams, streams that feed into community drinking water supplies, those laws are menial and incredibly insufficient in protecting aquatic species, but also in protecting communities who rely on those waterways for survival. So we know and have known, communities have known, that the Oregon Forest Practices Act needed to be rebooted because it is woefully inadequate as it stands. And so the ballot measure initiative was really intended to change that. And so community members, there was a grassroots effort that successfully filed a ballot measure to protect waterways in Oregon. And as a response, the timber industry kind of reactionarily filed a number of their own measures to sort of counter and undermine the citizens' ballot initiative, including a measure from the timber industry that would require the state of Oregon to compensate landowners for losses due to regulations that would protect waterways. And so this sort of became a race to see whose ballot measures would win. And a lot of folks thought that the grassroots initiative had a very good chance of passing. And a lot of folks worried that it didn't, and that the outcome would be not only a loss, but potentially a major loss in terms of the timber industry winning their initiatives. And so in the winter, in February of 2020, during this sort of stalemate between the sides, Governor Brown brokered a ceasefire, which looked like an agreement between 13 conservation and fishing organizations who were a part in some ways of this ballot initiative effort, and then 12 timber industry representatives from Big Timber who essentially agreed to sit at the table and come up with a compromise that both sides could agree to. And the reasoning on the conservation side was that we could achieve some victories, some material victories, while avoiding the potential pitfalls of losing entirely and have some control over those outcomes. Now, obviously, the controversy is that not everyone agreed with this. As I mentioned, some folks thought that the ballot initiative could have been a winning initiative. And not everyone who was a part of that grassroots initiative ended up with a seat at the table during the negotiations. And so I want to say clearly that I think despite where listeners on this stand in terms of this agreement, there is one thing that I think everyone can agree on, which is that there's much work to be done still. This agreement achieved some material changes and some major benefits, and there's a lot that still needs to happen. And so for the next bit of this answer, I'd love to just kind of flesh out what was achieved and what work still needs to be done, in the hopes that we can all, you know, wherever we stand on this, work together in finishing the job, in getting the pieces that aren't yet in place, and securing the protections that are truly needed across the board. So in terms of what was achieved by the Private Forest Accord in February of 2020 was the beginning, the announcement that there was some sort of a compromise that was going to happen. But it took a long time for the negotiation to actually get to a place where both sides could live with it. There was a couple important immediate outcomes from the initial agreement to sit at the table. So in February, that initial agreement or commitment to in good faith sit at the table also accomplished a couple important things regarding the spraying of chemicals by helicopters, also known as aerial spray, which is a big part of the logging practice. And so the initial changes that happened right off the bat in February of 2020 with this agreement to negotiate were an expansion of aerial spray buffers, or in other words, areas that you had to not aerial spray or not spray chemicals, buffer zones around places like homes, schools, surface water intakes, and drinking water supplies. It used to be the fact that helicopters could spray these poisonous chemicals within 60 feet of homes, schools, and surface water intakes and drinking water supplies. And now, since February of 2020, the rules were changed so that you actually need a 300-foot buffer, so from 60 to 300 feet from homes and schools and surface water intakes, and 110 feet from drinking water streams and fish-bearing streams, which is key. So immediately, we have this buffer of aerial spray expanded. And the other piece that came with that in the initial agreement is a real-time notification system. So for people who live in the timber matrix, where their backyards are private industrial timberlands that are being sprayed with these toxic chemicals, they obviously deserve the right to know when those sprays are happening, not only when they're happening, what day exactly and time exactly, but what they're spraying. And so this agreement put in place a system where rural Oregonians, no matter where you live, you can sign up where you live and receive real-time notification so that you know exactly when the sprays are happening in your neighborhood. So I want to pause here and say, you know, the elephant in the room is that obviously we shouldn't be having to deal with the aerial application of toxins in our watersheds at all. And I think, again, no matter where you stand on the private forest accord, I think we all actually agree on this. I think we agree that, you know, ideally we wouldn't have helicopters spraying toxic chemicals in our backyard water supplies. It's a big, important step to receive additional notification and to have larger buffers. Hugely material. And we're still working on this. Our work is unfinished until we no longer have to worry about the sprays that are happening in our backyard water supplies. And so that was one immediate piece. But as I said, the negotiations took a while. And so from February of 2020 all the way up to October of 2021, these negotiations were ongoing. Essentially, the framework that was agreed upon on the Oregon Forest Practices Act was to change no-cut buffers or buffers protecting streams, rivers, and bodies of water that you just can't cut those trees. It also agreed on a framework for steep slopes protection to minimize erosion and habitat and protect habitat, and for improving forest roads, and also for a long-term plan to be able to adapt forest practices in the future. And so in terms of riparian buffers, some significant changes. I think these are probably the biggest area for many of us in terms of concrete changes that came out of the agreement, which was signed finally in October of 2021. So these changes in buffers took the size of no-cut buffers from what used to be 20 feet for fish-bearing streams, of both large streams and medium streams and small streams that had fish, used to only have a 20-foot no-cut buffer. And now, large streams and medium streams that have fish have an 110-foot no-cut buffer. So from 20 to 110 feet that can't be cut. Protected trees around that fish-bearing stream. Additionally, along streams that don't have fish at all, that still run throughout the year, those also used to have only a 20-foot no-cut buffer. And now those are protected with a 75-foot no-cut buffer. So that's for streams that don't even have fish in them, but that obviously are still important to the stream network because they're providing water for many streams that do have fish. And so additionally, in addition to those large buffers, huge buffer expansion for fish-bearing streams and perennial or all-year-running non-fish-bearing streams, there is significant changes in protections around steep slopes. Obviously, we know that one of the primary concerns for fish populations is sedimentation in waterways caused by landslides and erosion from clear cutting along steep slopes. And so this agreement put in protections for the most landslide-prone areas, for steep slopes that are adjacent to fish-bearing streams, and actively failing slopes. And so these additional buffers not only were just for, you know, fish streams and perennial streams, but also protecting some headwater streams that are in particularly steep slope areas. And so hugely important, a lot of mapping and consideration went into that piece as well. And there were a number of other categories covered by the Private Forest Accord. In addition to the buffers and the steep slopes, there is a lot of attention paid to roads. There are massive commitments to decommissioning roads, upgrading culverts, providing fish passage in culverts that have been failing. And there's also new standards for where and how roads can be built. So a major addition is that there's a strong and focused effort to essentially assure that all roads are not connected from waterways, because as we know, roads can be an incredibly impactful part of the logging process and can be one of the main causes of increased sedimentation in streams. And so paying more attention to where and how roads are built and when they can be decommissioned is a huge part of this.
Right. And so you already talked a bit about aerial sprays, how we need more protection against them, but how the Forest Accord has been a help. Could you go into some detail on how those pesticides and herbicides are so damaging to the environment and people and pets living near them?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, something that so many Oregonians have been fighting for a long time to change. Basically, the practice of aerial herbicide spray is something that happens often directly after a private industrial clear cut, where the industry will come in order to reduce competition to the species that they want to keep, usually Douglas fir on the west side at least, they will fly a helicopter and do a spray of a concoction of chemicals, often a big mix, a slew of chemicals that sometimes and have historically included extremely toxic carcinogens such as 2,4-D and atrazine, which are both chemical components of Agent Orange. You know, those have historically been sprayed in aerial concoctions over private industrial timberlands. And these concoctions, once sprayed from a helicopter, obviously, you can imagine, don't just fall straight onto the ground. There's a significant amount of chemical drift, which we've begun calling toxic trespass, because basically your land as a person living nearby can be trespassed by chemicals that are being sprayed from an industrial operator next door. And these chemicals seep into the soil where they stay for many years, and they also seep into waterways and have been detected in community members' bodies and in their drinking water. Places like Triangle Lake, which is a community not far from Eugene, have actually done studies in conjunction with one of the Forest Waters Coalition groups, Beyond Toxics, for decades about the connection between industrial chemical spray and poisons in people's bodies. And a number of members of Triangle Lake's urine was tested positive for those chemical components, 2,4-D and atrazine. And so basically these chemicals become persistent in, local farms growing food, in the soils, in the waterways, in both municipal and well water, and in the bodies of the community members living next door.
Thanks. And I've also heard that these aerial sprays and toxins, such as the carcinogens that you mentioned, can be a significant factor in endangered species turning into extinct species. Do you think that these measures to reduce spraying will help preserve some of our native wildlife?
Absolutely. Sprays aren't just bad for human communities. They're also bad for wildlife. They're bad for aquatic species. They're poisons. These are toxins that we're putting into the environment. When we say we need to ban the aerial application of pesticides, we're not just saying for human communities, although that would be wonderful, but obviously, for all kinds of species. And there's a number of terrestrial species, not just aquatic species, but species that live on land, like the northern spotted owl or the marbled murrelet and the coastal marten, who are on the endangered species list, but continue to be poisoned with things like rodenticides by our neighborhood timber, big timber organizations. And so that is something that needs to be addressed. And then, on the bigger picture, what we're really looking at is the need to not just around the edges change the way that big timber is operating in our backyard forest, but really change the way that our communities are able to interact with and take ownership of the forests that impact us. And so we're looking at, not just these things around the edges, but also things like empowering municipalities to buy out their drinking watersheds and manage them for clean water, and ways to start, community-supported forestry in these places that are currently being clear-cut and planted and poisoned. And though this is, as I said, a really encouraging move that has gained some material steps in the right direction, we're dreaming big for the future, and hopefully we can keep working together until we achieve all of those victories.
And now for some brief news and events before we get back to Sam with the Forest Waters Coalition. If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on January 22nd. This month's book is As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock by Dina Gilio Whitaker. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid. That email is ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Spend Martin Luther King Jr. Day in a meaningful way by appreciating the power of cultural knowledge. the importance of diverse perspectives, and the role that environmental stewardship plays on self-identity. Thrive Umpqua is proud to partner with First Indigenous Nations Society, UC Veg, United Communities AmeriCorps, and the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians to host the first Umpqua Valley Land Celebration at Eastwood Elementary. From 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. January 17th, engage with tribal members and learn about Native histories through cultural demonstrations, traditional music, and enjoy food and drink provided by UC Veg. All ages are welcome, masks are required, and you're encouraged to dress warm for the land blessing to take place at the start of the event at the Plank House just east of Eastwood. Register for the event online through the Thrive Umpqua Facebook page. We hope to see you there! If you're looking for something to do outdoors to make positive change for your environment and community on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Umpqua Watersheds will also be hosting a river cleanup at Stewart Park, January 17th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tools and refreshments will be provided. Remember, Martin Luther King Day is a day on, not a day off. For more information, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
Sam, Umpqua Watersheds is really puts a lot of time into ground truthing on the Umpqua National Forest, especially with the Archie Creek fire recently, as well as on BLM lands and looking at the plethora of timber sales that the BLM seems to be putting out. Can you talk about the impact of road construction and other forest damaging activities as a result of logging?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also want to just plug how important it is to be ground truthing. It's one of the tools in our toolbox that we have that is the best way that we can kind of expose the destruction happening on the ground and cut through some of the industry rhetoric like we've been talking about. The facade is by, you know, I was referencing earlier, knocking on doors, but ground truthing can also, and most often looks like going out to the forest and seeing what is physically there. And so when folks do that, in addition to looking at forest conditions, we're also looking at things like road construction and roads that is often really overlooked when people talk about logging and often associated aerial spray. One of the other associated activities that people forget about is the network of roads that are needed in order to log an area. Logging roads can be one of the most destructive things, activities associated with logging, simply because they're obviously clear-cut corridors, but then they're creating these permanent roadways that are being used by, you know, large logging trucks. And those, you know, those steep slopes, cut slopes often are cutting over streams or are nearby streams. And the sedimentation and runoff coming from the road and the traffic and sedimentation from the side of the road often are pouring right into nearby streams and waterways. And so our rules for logging roads have been extremely ineffective at protecting salmonid species from the impacts of this sedimentation in their waterways. They've also been not good enough in requiring fish passage. And so one of the major issues has been roads being built over waterways that occasionally have fish or that people don't realize have fish and actually do have fish. And all of a sudden these roads function like a dam preventing fish passage because there's no culvert or not a suitable culvert for these fish populations. And so yeah, roads, you know, if one of the recommendations that we would have, you know, for doing better in terms of our forested watersheds would be to decommission unused logging roads, which means to shut them down and turn them back into unroad them, basically. And also to intentionally and strategically limit road construction in any future logging projects that occur, because it is one of the most low-hanging fruit ways that we can ensure protection of our waterways is we can stop building unnecessary logging roads.
Yes, excellent. We spent a lot of time going into some of those fur roads that should be decommissioned that they included in timber sale proposals. It doesn't make any sense why they need to open those up, especially in the fire areas. Some of those areas have green trees, so it doesn't make any sense to us. And fortunately, we've been able to make some headway in getting Forest Service, in this case, to take some of those spur roads off and hopefully eventually decommission those roads.
That would be great to see. Thanks to you all for doing that work too. I hope we can unify around an ask like that.
Yes, one of the things we do with ground truthing is recently with the fires is to get out early and take as many pictures both on the ground and via drone so we can show before. And then as the different activities happen, we take pictures on the ground and the air. And then over the years, we'll be able to show before and after. And here's some things. Of course, a lot of times when we're adding comments to timber sales proposals and trying to get them to change some what they're doing, we get finding of no significant impact when we know there is significant impact. So we have to show what it looked like before. Here's what we said would happen. And then unfortunately, some of the areas that get treated go back 5 years. This is what it looks like now. And maybe in some areas, we're seeing some of the thinning has helped. And we are learning as well as the agencies are learning the impact of that, especially where we can show, hey, we said this would happen. This would have an impact on the ecosystem and the wildlife and the streams and the forests themselves if you cut too much. And we're able to show, yes, this is what we said would happen, and it did happen. Hopefully that will have an impact on future decisions.
So I believe that some of the problem here is that people don't realize why that negative impact on the forest is important. People oftentimes just think of the forest as something important for specifically timber, but it has a lot more use. It has a lot more value. Sam, could you describe some of the value that forests have and why they're important?
Oh, happily. Thank you for this question. Sometimes I think we can be so in the weeds on this issue that we forget to step back and just ask that question of why do we even care? So what? And it's a good question, honestly. And I don't think that most Oregonians know that 80% of us actually get our drinking water from forested streams. And that's literal. I'm not talking about some sort of metaphor for where our water comes from, but we are literally drinking water from streams that are running through our forests. And when I say our forests, I'm talking both federal public lands and state public lands, but also these private lands that make up this significant portion of our state. And so that's one huge reason to care about our forests, is because that's where most of our drinking water comes from, quite literally. But, you know, also our forests are doing so much more than just providing us humans with drinking water. One thing that we often talk about in terms of this context that we're now living in, which is climate change, is the power of our forests in essentially safeguarding our communities from the potential worst impacts of a changing climate. And what I mean by that is our forests are, I don't know if any of you all remember, I'm sure you can't forget the heat wave that came through this past summer. You know, we had, at least here in Portland, you know, 110 degree days where it was so hot. And the only thing I could think to do was to go to the forest. And the temperature was literally 10 degrees colder, 15 degrees colder. And that's a functional thing that our forests are doing, not just for those of us humans who can go there, but for the entire planet, is they're a cooling system. They're, you know, keeping temperatures temperate. And that's hugely, hugely important in a changing climate. Also, you know, in terms of a changing climate, one thing that we know we can expect is more heat and drought. And we're going to have water crises on our hands like we've never seen before in our lifetimes and, you know, in our history books. And this is something that we can directly address through the natural solution of keeping forests intact. Forests are best at storing water. They're storing water and releasing it when it's necessary in the summer months. Protecting old forests is the best way we can prevent issues with low stream flow in the summer months when it's dry. And in terms of storing things too, when we're talking about storage, we can't forget to talk about carbon storage, which obviously is hugely important. We have so many folks talking about all of these alternative ways to store carbon and technologies for carbon sequestration and storage. But Oregon, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have the most incredible natural solution for carbon storage, and that is our forests. Our forests, in fact, store in the Pacific Northwest the most carbon per acre of any forest in the world, and that includes the Amazon. Our forests are a global solution to climate change because they are sequestering and, importantly, storing, keeping carbon safely stored in their trees and dead wood, rotting wood, all of that is storing carbon in the soil, in the plants, on the forest floor. And so those are hugely important reasons enough, but I would be irresponsible to not also mention habitat and species, wherein our climate emergency is intertwined deeply, as the IPCC has acknowledged, with a biodiversity crisis. And this biodiversity crisis is looking like an unparalleled species extinction event. And a huge reason for this is habitat loss. And so our forests are providing safe homes to threatened species and also critical species that we require in order to survive and thrive. And so, you know, those are a few reasons. For me, you know, as a person who loves being in the woods, there are endless reasons to protect the forest. But I think, you know, in terms of our own ability to stay sane and thrive and stay stable as communities, the forests are the best tool that we have.
Absolutely. It's so inspiring to go out into the forest. It gives you hope and resiliency of nature and why we need to protect it. I know there's a paper just came out in the last couple of weeks that talks about creating strategic forest reserves. Have you read that? What is your opinion of that paper?
Yeah, so Beverly Law is one of the lead scientists on that paper, is an incredible inspiration to many of us who are doing forest conservation work and also just thinking critically about what role forests play in the global climate crisis. And yeah, that paper has been pretty groundbreaking, I think, and should be pretty groundbreaking for all of us, because it essentially asserts that we can approach the climate crisis with better strategy if we were to thoughtfully set aside areas of forest land that are both important for carbon sequestration and storage, but also important for climate resiliency. And so that's really key, is that we're looking at which forests are able to store carbon, but also which forests are important for things like fighting against drought, for providing critical habitat, for providing key connective corridors for species, buffering communities from wildfire risk. These are all things that come along with preparing for the climate crisis. And the paper also includes a series of maps that show where these strategic climate reserves, because it's not just about carbon, where those could be located. And it's pretty incredible stuff. I think there's a lot in there, and I'll admit to not having read the entire paper yet, but it's an incredible resource, I think, for those of us who are thinking critically about where and how to protect forests to combat against the future of climate chaos.
Yes, Stanley Petrowski did a whole show on the paper, Beverly Law's paper, on his last radioactive restoration show. So folks can go on KQUA website and look at that podcast from last week. That would be on Christmas Day is when he had that up. It was very interesting.
Awesome.
So circling back a little bit to drinking water, the Forest Waters Coalition has a drinking water campaign. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Could you discuss that a little bit and maybe what's next?
Sure. We started focusing in earnest on drinking water as we realized that the private forest accord wasn't addressing that as a particular issue in and of itself. And really, this effort was inspired by folks like the North Coast Communities for Watershed Protection, who have been working on drinking water because their drinking watershed, the Jetty Creek Waterway in Rockaway Beach, at least for Rockaway Beach, as I mentioned before, has seen over 95% of it cut, clear cut, in just the past 20 years. And so the result has been that the Jetty Creek watershed has received more drinking water quality alerts than any watershed in the state at the time that all this logging was happening at its peak. And these water quality alerts were a direct result of that clear cut logging and associated chemical spraying in that watershed. And so digging further into this issue, it's become clear that this is not, and I want to say this clearly, this is not a single watershed or a one watershed issue. This is not just the watershed of Rockaway Beach, Jetty Creek. This is, unfortunately, an issue that plagues so many watersheds across the state of Oregon, especially on the West Coast. As I mentioned before, a number of drinking watersheds are almost entirely owned by private industrial timberland. There are many drinking watersheds that have been over 60% logged clear cut in their drinking watersheds in the past 20 years. These practices are ongoing, and unfortunately, we've uncovered through our digging in this that there's woefully inadequate monitoring and record keeping on this subject on behalf of our agencies. When we try to investigate things like how much logging is happening by drinking watershed, we found out that the Oregon Department of Forestry doesn't monitor by drinking watershed. They're not even considering the impacts of industrial logging. They don't have a limitation or a cap on how much industrial logging or spraying can happen by a drinking watershed. And so it's just this issue that's really not gaining attention as its own issue. And we don't really have time to continue the practices as is. We're already seeing places like Wheeler, like the community of Warrenton, like Corbett, Oregon, already having to put in, you know, millions of dollars to get new water treatment plants because of the impacts of industrial logging. And so in that context of climate change that we were talking about, we can't afford to continue these practices. Communities literally cannot afford to buy new water treatment systems in order to have clean drinking water. And these practices are going to threaten community drinking water supplies if we don't do something about them now. And so our campaign right now is multi-pronged. One of the things that we're trying to do is basically tell these stories a bit better. I mentioned that we're doing mapping projects. We're also doing storytelling projects where we're connecting with community members on the ground who are experiencing these issues, often water managers who are dealing with, you know, these water treatment issues, and trying to tell their stories a bit better and make it clear to decision makers that this isn't just an issue that, you know, is in one watershed. This is a statewide issue. The other prong is we're engaging with our agencies, our regulatory agencies, the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Department of Forestry. The DEQ is responsible for implementing the Clean Water Act, which protects our source water, the rivers and streams. We're trying to influence them to do a better job at that work, and also Oregon Department of Forestry to change the practices that are most threatening our drinking watersheds. And then the last prong is, of course, you know, legislative avenues. We are still exploring legislative avenues that could actually achieve some clear material changes. There's a number of laws on the books right now in Oregon that are just really problematic for those of us who want to protect drinking watersheds that we would love to see changed. And there's also a number of really low-hanging fruit protections that we could see put in place, like, for instance, banning aerial spraying in drinking watersheds that we'd like to see happen now. So we're working on a number of different levels. The most important thing, though, is that we're working with communities on the ground who are impacted by these issues. That is the kind of like the juice of what we do, is the stories from folks who have stakes in the game.
So, Sam, a lot of working in environmental conservation is very much of a David and Goliath position. We have pennies to what millions of dollars that the industry has. So it's a big challenge, but fortunately we have passionate people and volunteers. This past year, UMC Watersheds had over 3,000 volunteers hours that we've logged to do the work what we're doing, but it's hard. It's very hard. How do we go about getting other organizations part of the Forest Waters Coalition? How do we go about getting our listeners involved in doing what we do to make a difference for the watersheds?
Thank you for that question. Yes, I think that we are always in a David and Goliath scenario, which is why our grassroots power is so, so, so important. One of the things that we run up against time and again when speaking to decision makers who have been heavily influenced by big timber is this claim that, you know, maybe this isn't actually an issue. Maybe environmentalists are fabricating or, you know, fear-mongering around logging, and maybe this issue is just all made up. And so one of the best ways that we can cut through that nonsense is by connecting with people who've seen it firsthand and who can speak to the reality of the issue on the ground. And so in terms of partnerships that we build, to me, they're, you know, obviously in terms of growing a movement, we want everyone who wants to be a part of this. So I'll start by saying that. We certainly need more people who are able to navigate the halls of Salem and who understand the policy wonkiness going on. And we certainly need more folks who can do those ends of things. And we also, though, really, really need more folks who are seeing this happen in their backyard, who are organizing on the ground with their communities, who are signed up with the state's electronic notification system, which the acronym is FERNS. which can let them know when clear cuts and sprays are happening in their watershed, who are signed up and who are monitoring and who are engaged and who want to be more engaged. We want to work more with people who are curious about this whole issue and need some tools and resources, because we are putting on trainings, we are developing handbooks and guides for people to get involved. We really want to work with water managers in whatever position you're in your community. If you're responsible for maintaining water quality or for helping provide clean drinking water, we want to connect with you if you see concerns in your watershed. You know, we want to work with local elected officials who are, you know, wanting to better protect their municipal drinking water supplies in a future of climate change. We want to work with allies in the state legislature. And, you know, I think most importantly, we really want to work with people on the ground who are impacted, with our frontline community members who have the most skin in the game when it comes to whether or not these protections can happen. So I firmly believe in, you know, building a really complex and diverse movement with a lot of different voices coming from a lot of different places. And the most important thing that we can do, I think, is to elevate the voices of folks on the ground who are seeing this firsthand, so that we can't have anyone being fooled anymore by the lies that this isn't an issue, so that everyone recognizes this is an issue and has faces and names and places to help describe that issue.
So some of those voices that you mentioned are going to be people who aren't necessarily aligned with any organization or who may not know how to get involved, individuals. How can the individual, such as the listeners to this radio show, get involved? What are the first steps that they can take to make a difference?
Yeah, well, we have a growing network called the Forest Waters Watch Network, which is specifically for individuals who are interested in getting more involved in monitoring what's happening in their watersheds and actually stopping destructive practices. And so the way that you can get involved is you can email me at sam@forestwaters.org, and you can get me directly and I can plug you in with that network, or you can go to forestwaters.org, the website, and there's a sign up link there to get involved with the Forest Waters Watch community. And basically from there, we share and communicate around opportunities to take action. People get to meet and kind of share their stories of what they're seeing in their watersheds. We put out opportunities for engagement, resources, we have trainings, and especially in the new year, we are planning a few trainings that are on that electronic notification system that I keep mentioning, helping people get signed up for that, and also on kind of next steps with our drinking water campaign. So now is a really good time for people to plug in there.
So in Umpqua Watershed's quarterly newsletter, we focused one of our articles on our coalitions, and right at the top was the Forest Waters Coalition. And I'd love our organization and other organizations to share what's happening with the Forest Waters Coalition on a regular basis, trying to get people to the website. Maybe what we've talked about doing is just having a dedicated part of our website focused on the various collaborations. Do you have any ideas or suggestions and how we and other organizations can do more to support the Forest Waters Coalition?
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for both those questions, because there's definitely roles in all of this for individuals who are just grassroots community members, and also organizations who are wanting to get more involved. And so for organizations who aren't yet members of the Forest Waters Coalition, you should totally consider joining our coalition, because this is really where a lot of the work on watershed and private industrial policy is being done. We could certainly, as I mentioned before, use more staff members and dedicated time to people who are able to run and help with our communications campaigns, our policy campaigns, our grassroots campaigns. And so we could certainly use more hands on deck for that. So please join our coalition. If you already are a member of our coalition, we have a number of different working groups and open projects that could always use more hands helping with. We have a policy working group, which is working on both engaging with agencies and state legislators. We have a communications working group, which is working on the storytelling aspects that I spoke about. And there's always room for more. And so if folks have you know, a platform such as your website, that's perfect and a great space to host information. If you have a newsletter, we typically have calls to action at least once every couple months. So sharing those calls to action that get sent out through the Forest Waters Coalition listserv with your members is a great way to amplify our work. But also if you have a project idea, we're all ears. We really want to be a space that houses creative, thoughtful projects around this sort of work. So definitely get connected if you can.
That's great. We have a monthly email that we send out called Watersheds Moments. And I will send you an email. It comes out on the 8th of every month so that we can get a little section for the Forest Waters Coalition in our monthly email. So I think that's a way we can help.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for everything you had to say.
An important part of what Umpqua Watersheds does is to represent the Umpqua Basin and beyond in many coalitions and alliances that help shape public policy at local, regional, and national levels. We're very heartened by the great work that is conducted and the results these groups are producing. In the last 2 months, we've seen improvements in how private land is being managed related to timber harvest. The Forest Accord, reached by 13 conservation groups, including Umpqua Watersheds, and 13 timber industry groups, gives us hope that progress can be made in improving the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which provides some of the weakest environmental protections on the West Coast and Pacific Northwest. Other coalitions we are involved with are the Forest Waters Coalition that we discussed in this interview. We're also involved in the Pacific Northwest Climate Alliance, which includes 47 individual organizations. We are also very proud to be part of the United Communities AmeriCorps program. Our AmeriCorps do tremendous work, including producing Living Downstream. We're also actively involved with the Umpqua Audubon Society, local schools including Phoenix School, Umpqua Community College, and other local groups in trying to make a difference for the Umpqua.